initial plausibility, and two, similarity to the present world. He followed this a few days later with 8 dense pages in which he attempted to create a logical, internally consistent theory of the imagination. "He loved these ideas," said Barbara. "It's something very basic about decision-making that fascinated him. It's the choice you don't take." He groped for titles, so that he might know what he was writing about. In his earliest notes in the file, he scribbled the phrase, "the undoing heuristic," and gave the new theory the name possibility theory. He then changed it to scenario theory, and then again to the theory of alternative states. In the last notes he made on the subject, he called it shadow theory. "The major point of shadow theory," Amos wrote to himself, "is that the context of alternatives, or the possibility set, determines our expectations, our interpretations, our recollection, and our attribution of reality, as well as the affective states which it induces." Toward the end of his thinking on the subject, he summed up a lot in a single sentence. "Reality is a cloud of possibility, not a point." It wasn't that Amos had no interest in Danny's thoughts. It was that they were no longer talking in the same room, with the door closed. The conversation that he and Danny were meant to be having together, each was more or less having alone. Because of the new distance between them, each was far more aware where the ideas had come from. "We know who had the idea, because of the physical separation, and because the idea is in a letter," Amos would complain to Miles Shore. "Before, we would have picked up the phone at the beginning of an idea. Now you develop an idea, and you become committed to them, and they become more personal, and you remember you had them. Initially, we never had that." Committed to his new idea, Danny had taken it back rather than let Amos take it apart and remake it into something more like his own. Amos continued to fly to Vancouver every other week, but there was a new tension between them. Amos clearly wished to believe that they might collaborate as they had before. Danny did not. He'd anticipated his own envy and built it into a decision about Amos. Chapter 12. This Cloud of Possibility. Amos was in Israel on a visit in 1984 when he received the phone call telling him that he'd been given a MacArthur Genius Grant. The award came with $250,000, plus an extra $50,000 for research, a fancy healthcare plan, and a press release celebrating Amos as one of the thinkers who had exhibited extraordinary originality and dedication in their creative pursuits and a marked capacity for self-direction. The only work of Amos's cited in the press release was the work he'd done with Danny. It didn't mention Danny. Amos disliked prizes. He thought that they exaggerated the differences between people, did more harm than good, and created more misery than joy, as for every winner, there were many others who deserved to win, or felt they did. The MacArthur became a case in point. "He wasn't grateful for that prize," said his friend Maya Bar-Hillel, who was with Amos in Jerusalem shortly after the prize was announced. "He was pissed. He said, 'What are these people thinking? How can they give a prize to just one of a winning pair? Did they not realize they are dealing the collaboration a death blow?'" Amos didn't like prizes, but he kept on getting them anyway. Before the MacArthur Genius Grant, he had been admitted into the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. Soon after the MacArthur, he received a Guggenheim Fellowship and an invitation to join the National Academy of Sciences. That last honor was seldom bestowed on scientists who weren't U.S. citizens, and it wasn't bestowed upon Danny. There would follow honorary degrees from Yale and the University of Chicago, among others, but the MacArthur was the prize Amos would dwell upon as an example of the damage caused by prizes. "He thought it was myopic beyond forgiveness," said Bar-Hillel. "It was genuine agony. He wasn't putting on a show for me." Along with the prizes came a steady drizzle of books and articles praising Amos for the work he had done with Danny, as if he had done it alone. When others spoke of their joint work, they put Danny's name second, if they mentioned it at all. Tversky and Kahneman. "You are very generous in giving me credit for articulating the relationship between representativeness and psychoanalysis," Amos wrote to a fellow psychologist who had sent Amos his new journal article. "These ideas, however, were developed in discussions with Danny, so you should mention both our names, or, if that appears awkward, omit mine." An author of a book credited Amos with noticing the illusory sense of effectiveness felt by Israeli Air Force flight instructors after they'd criticized a pilot. I am somewhat uncomfortable with the label the Tversky effect, Amos wrote to the author. This work has been done in collaboration with my longtime friend and colleague Daniel Kahneman, so I should not be singled out. In fact, Daniel Kahneman was the one who observed the effect of pilots' training, so if this phenomenon is to be named after a person, it should be called the Kahneman effect. The American view of his collaboration with Danny mystified Amos. People saw Amos as the brilliant one and Danny as the careful one, said Amos's friend and Stanford colleague, Percy Diaconis. And Amos would say, it's exactly the opposite. Amos's graduate students at Stanford gave him a nickname, Famous Amos. You knew that everyone knew him, and you knew everyone wanted to hang out with him, said Brown University professor of psychology Stephen Sloman, who studied with Amos in the late 1980s. The maddening thing is that Amos seemed almost indifferent to the attention. He happily ignored the ever-growing media requests. You probably won't be better off after you have appeared on TV than before, he said. He tossed out as many invitations unopened as he acknowledged. None of this arose from a sense of modesty. Amos knew his own value. He didn't need to make a point of not caring what people thought of him. He actually just didn't care all that much. The deal Amos offered the encroaching world was that their interaction was to be on his terms. And the world accepted the deal. United States congressmen called him for advice on bills they were drafting. The National Basketball Association called to hear his argument about statistical fallacies in basketball. The United States Secret Service flew him to Washington so that he could advise them on how to predict and deter threats to the political leaders under their protection. The North Atlantic Treaty Organization flew him to the French Alps to teach them about how people made decisions in conditions of uncertainty. Amos seemed able to walk into any problem, however alien to him, and make the people dealing with it feel as if he grasped its essence better than they did. The University of Illinois flew him to a conference about metaphorical thinking, for instance, only to have Amos argue that a metaphor was actually a substitute for thinking. Because metaphors are vivid and memorable, and because they are not readily subjected to critical analysis, they can have considerable impact on human judgment even when they are inappropriate, useless, or misleading, said Amos. They replace genuine uncertainty about the world with semantic ambiguity. A metaphor is a cover-up. Danny couldn't help but keep noticing the new attention Amos was receiving for the work they had done together. Economists now wanted Amos at their conferences, but then so did linguists and philosophers and sociologists and computer scientists, even though Amos hadn't the faintest interest in the PC that came with his Stanford office. What could I do with computers, he said, after he declined Apple's offer to donate 20 new Macs to the Stanford psychology department. You get fed up with not being invited to the same conferences, even when you would not want to go, Danny confessed to the Harvard psychiatrist Miles Shore. My life would be better if he weren't invited to so many. In Israel, Danny had been the person real-world people came to when they had some real-world problem. The people in real-world America came to Amos, even when it wasn't obvious that Amos had any reason to know what he was talking about. He had a hell of an impact on what we did, said Jack Maher, who was in charge of training 7,000 pilots at Delta Airlines, when he sought Amos's help. In the late 1980s, Delta had suffered a series of embarrassing incidents. We didn't kill anyone, said Maher, but we'd had people getting lost, people landing at the wrong airports. The incidents nearly always could be traced back to some bad decision made by a Delta captain. We needed a decision model, and I looked for one, but they didn't exist, said Maher, and Tversky's name kept popping up. Maher met with Amos for a few hours and told him his problems. He started speaking in math, said Maher. When he got into linear regression equations, I just started to laugh, then he laughed and stopped doing it. Amos then explained in plain English his work with Danny. He helped us to understand why pilots sometimes made bad decisions, said Maher. He said, you're not going to change people's decision-making under duress. You aren't going to stop pilots from making these mental errors. You aren't going to train the decision-making weaknesses out of the pilots. What Delta Airlines should do, Amos suggested, was to change its decision-making environments. The mental mistakes that led pilots of planes bound for Miami to land boneheadedly in Fort Lauderdale were woven into human nature. People had trouble seeing when their minds were misleading them. On the other hand, they could sometimes see when other people's minds were misleading them, but the cockpit culture of a commercial airliner did not encourage people to point out the mental errors of the man in charge. Captains at the time would be complete autocratic jerks who insisted on running the show, said Marr. The way to stop the captain from landing the plane in the wrong airport, Amos insisted, was to train others in the cockpit to question his judgment. He changed the way we trained pilots, said Marr. We changed the culture in the cockpit, and the autocratic jerk became no longer acceptable. Those mistakes haven't happened since. By the 1980s, the ideas that Danny and Amos had hatched together were infiltrating places the two had never imagined them entering. Success created, among other things, a new market for critics. We started this unknown field, Amos told Miles Shore in the summer of 1983. We were shaking trees and challenging the establishment. Now we are the establishment, and people are shaking our tree. Those people tended to be self-serious intellectuals. Upon encountering Danny and Amos's work, more than a few academics experienced the sensation that a person feels when a total stranger walks up and begins a sentence, "Don't take this the wrong way, but whatever might follow, you just know that you're not going to like it." The sound of laughter coming from the other side of Amos and Danny's closed door hadn't helped. It caused other intellectuals to wonder about their motives. "The glee is what created the suspicion," said the philosopher Avishai Margalit. "They looked like people standing in front of a monkey cage, making faces at the monkeys. There was too much joy there. They said, 'We're monkeys too.' But no one believed them. The feeling was that the joy that they have is to trick people, and it stuck. It was a real problem for them." At a conference back in the early 1970s, Danny was introduced to a prominent philosopher named Max Black and tried to explain to the great man his work with Amos. "I'm not interested in the psychology of stupid people," said Black, and walked away. Danny and Amos didn't think of their work as the psychology of stupid people. Their very first experiments dramatizing the weakness of people's statistical intuitions had been conducted on professional statisticians. For every simple problem that fooled undergraduates, they could come up with a more complicated version to fool professors. At least a few professors didn't like the idea of that. "Give people a visual illusion and they say, 'It's only my eyes,'" said Princeton psychologist Eldar Shafir. "Give them a linguistic illusion, they're fooled, but they say, 'No big deal.' Then you give them one of Amos and Danny's examples and they say, 'Now you're insulting me.'" The first to take their work personally were the psychologists whose work it had trumped. Amos's former teacher, Ward Edwards, had written the original journal article in 1954, inviting psychologists to investigate the assumptions of economics. Still, he'd never imagined this: two Israelis walking into the room and making a mockery of the entire conversation. In late 1970, after reading early drafts of Amos and Danny's papers on human judgment, Edwards wrote to complain. In what would be the first of many agitated letters, he adopted the tone of a wise and indulgent master speaking to his naive pupils. How could Amos and Danny possibly believe that there was anything to learn from putting silly questions to undergraduates? "I think your data collection methods are such that I don't take seriously a single experimental finding you present," wrote Edwards. These students they had turned into their lab rats were careless and inattentive. And if they are confused and inattentive, they are much less likely to behave more like competent, intuitive statisticians. For every supposed limitation of the human mind Danny and Amos had uncovered, Edwards had an explanation. The gambler's fallacy, for instance. If people thought that a coin, after landing on heads 5 times in a row, was more likely, on the 6th toss, to land on tails, it wasn't because they misunderstood randomness. It was because people got bored doing the same thing all the time. Amos took the trouble to answer, almost politely, that first letter from his former professor. "It was certainly a pleasure to read your detailed comments on our papers and to see that, right or wrong, you have not lost any of your old fighting spirit," he began, before describing his former professor as not cogent. "In particular," Amos continued, "the objections you raised against our experimental method are simply unsupported. In essence, you engage in the practice of criticizing a procedural departure without showing how the departure might account for the results obtained. You do not present either contradictory data or a plausible alternative interpretation of our findings. Instead, you express a strong bias against our method of data collection and in favor of yours." This position is certainly understandable, yet it is hardly convincing. Edwards was not pleased, but he kept his anger to himself for a few years. No one wanted to get in a fight with Amos, said the psychologist Irv Biederman. Not in public. I only once ever saw anyone ever do it. There was this philosopher at a conference. He gets up to give his talk. He's going to challenge heuristics. Amos was there. When he finished talking, Amos got up to rebut. It was like an ISIS beheading, but with humor. Edwards must have sensed in any open conflict with Amos the possibility of being on the painful end of an ISIS beheading with humor. And yet Amos had championed the idea that man was a good intuitive statistician. He needed to say something. In the late 1970s, he finally found a principle on which to take a stand. The masses were not equipped to grasp Amos and Danny's message. The subtleties were beyond them. People needed to be protected from misleading themselves into thinking that their minds were less trustworthy than they actually were. I do not know whether you realize just how far that message has spread or how devastating its effects have been, Edwards wrote to Amos in September of 1979. I attended the organizational meeting of the Society for Medical Decision-Making 1.5 weeks ago. I would estimate that every third paper mentioned your work in passing, mostly as justification for avoiding human intuition judgment, decision-making, and other intellectual processes. Even sophisticated doctors were getting from Danny and Amos only the crude, simplified message that their minds could never be trusted. What would become of medicine, of intellectual authority, of experts? Edwards sent Amos a working draft of his assault on Danny and Amos's work, and hoped that Amos would leave him with his dignity. Amos didn't. The tone is snide, the evaluation of evidence is unfair, and there are too many technical difficulties to begin to discuss, Amos wrote in a curt note to Edwards. We are in sympathy with your attempt to redress what you regard as a distorted view of man, but we regret that you chose to do so by presenting a distorted view of our work. In his reply, Edwards did a fair impression of a man who has just realized that his fly is unzipped, as he backpedals off a cliff. He offered up his personal problems, they ranged from serious jet lag to a decade's worth of personal frustrations, as excuses for his failed paper, and then went on to more or less concede that he'd wished he'd never written it. What especially embarrasses me is that after working so long as I did on trying to put this thing together, I should have been as blind to its many flaws as I was, he wrote to both Amos and Danny, before saying how he intended to entirely rewrite his paper and hoped very much to avoid any public controversy with them. Not everyone knew enough to be afraid of Amos. An Oxford philosopher named L. Jonathan Cohen raised a small philosophy-sized ruckus with a series of attacks in books and journals. He found alien the idea that you might learn something about the human mind by putting questions to people. He argued that as man had created the concept of rationality, he must, by definition, be rational. Rational was whatever most people did, or as Danny put it in a letter that he reluctantly sent in response to one of Cohen's articles, any error that attracts a sufficient number of votes is not an error at all. Cohen labored to demonstrate that the mistakes discovered by Amos and Danny either were not mistakes or were the result of mathematical or scientific ignorance in people, easily remedied by a bit of exposure to college professors. We both make a living by teaching probability and statistics, Stanford's Percy Diaconis and David Friedman of the University of California at Berkeley wrote to the journal Behavioral and Brain Sciences, which had published one of Cohen's attacks. Over and over again, we see students and colleagues and ourselves making certain kinds of mistakes. Even the same mistake may be repeated by the same person many times. Cohen is wrong in dismissing this as the result of mathematical or scientific ignorance. But by then it was clear that no matter how often people trained in statistics affirmed the truth of Danny and Amos's work, people who weren't would insist that they knew better. Upon their arrival in North America, Amos and Danny had published a flurry of papers together. Mostly it was stuff they'd had in the works when they'd left Israel. But in the early 1980s, what they wrote together was not done in the same way as before. Amos wrote a piece on loss aversion under both their names, to which Danny added a few stray paragraphs. Danny wrote up on his own what Amos had called the Undoing Project, titled it The Simulation Heuristic, and published it with both their names on top in a book that collected their articles, along with others by students and colleagues. and then set out to explore the rules of the imagination, not with Amos, but with his younger colleague at the University of British Columbia, Dale Miller. Amos wrote an article addressed directly to economists to repair technical flaws in prospect theory. Advances in Prospect Theory, it was called, and though Amos did much of the work on it with his graduate student Rich Gonzalez, it ran as a journal article by Danny and Amos. Amos said that it had always been Kahneman and Tversky, and that this had to be Kahneman and Tversky, and that it would be really strange to add a third person to it, said Gonzalez. Thus, they maintained the illusion that they were still working together, much as before, even as the forces pulling them apart gathered strength. The growing crowd of common enemies failed to unite them. Danny was increasingly uneasy with the attitude Amos took toward their opponents. Amos was built to fight. Danny was built to survive. He shied from conflict. Now that their work was under attack, Danny adopted a new policy, to never review a paper that made him angry. It served as an excuse to ignore any act of hostility. Amos accused Danny of identifying with the enemy, and he wasn't far off. Danny almost found it easier to imagine himself in his opponent's shoes than in his own. In some strange way, Danny contained within himself his own opponent. He didn't need another. Amos, to be Amos, needed opposition. Without it, he had nothing to triumph over. And Amos, like his homeland, lived in a state of readiness for battle. Amos didn't have Danny's feeling that we should all think together and work together, said Walter Mischel, who had been the chair of Stanford's psychology department when it hired Amos. He thought, fuck you. That sentiment must have been passing through Amos's mind in the early 1980s even more often than it usually did. The critics publishing attacks on his work with Danny were the least of it. At conferences and in conversations, Amos heard over and over from economists and decision theorists that he and Danny had exaggerated human fallibility, or that the kinks in the mind that they had observed were artificial, or only present in the minds of college undergraduates, or something. A lot of people with whom Amos interacted had big investments in the idea that people were rational. Amos was perplexed by their inability to admit defeat in an argument he had plainly won. Amos wanted to crush the opposition, said Danny. It just got under his skin more than it did mine. He wanted to find something to shut people up, which, of course, you can never do. Toward the end of 1980, or maybe it was early 1981, Amos came to Danny with a plan to write an article that would end the discussion. Their opponents might never admit defeat, intellectuals seldom did, but they might at least decide to change the subject. Winning by embarrassment, Amos called it. Amos wanted to demonstrate the raw power of the mind's rules of thumb to mislead. He and Danny had stumbled upon some bizarre phenomena back in Israel and never fully explored their implications. Now they did. As ever, they crafted careful vignettes to reveal the inner workings of the minds of the people they asked to judge them. Amos's favorite was about Linda. Linda is 31 years old, single, outspoken, and very bright. She majored in philosophy. As a student, she was deeply concerned with issues of discrimination and social justice, and also participated in anti-nuclear demonstrations. Linda was designed to be the stereotype of a feminist. Danny and Amos asked, to what degree does Linda resemble the typical member of each of the following classes? 1. Linda is a teacher in elementary school. 2. Linda works in a bookstore and takes yoga classes. 3. Linda is active in the feminist movement. 4. Linda is a psychiatric social worker. 5. Linda is a member of the League of Women Voters. 6. Linda is a bank teller. 7. Linda is an insurance salesperson. 8. Linda is a bank teller and is active in the feminist movement. Danny passed out the Linda vignette to students at the University of British Columbia. In this first experiment, two different groups of students were given 4 of the 8 descriptions and asked to judge the odds that they were true. One of the groups had Linda is a bank teller on its list. The other got Linda is a bank teller and is active in the feminist movement. Those were the only 2 descriptions that mattered, though of course the students didn't know that. The group given Linda is a bank teller and is active in the feminist movement judged it more likely than the group assigned Linda is a bank teller. That result was all that Danny and Amos needed to make their big point. The rules of thumb people use to evaluate probability led to misjudgments. Linda is a bank teller and is active in the feminist movement could never be more probable than Linda is a bank teller. Linda is a bank teller and active in the feminist movement was just a special case of Linda is a bank teller. Linda is a bank teller included Linda is a bank teller and activist in the feminist movement, along with Linda is a bank teller and likes to walk naked through Serbian forests and all other bank-telling Lindas. One description was entirely contained by the other. People were blind to logic when it was embedded in a story. Describe a very sick old man and ask people, which is more probable, that he will die within a week or die within a year? More often than not, they will say he'll die within a week. Their mind latches onto a story of imminent death, and the story masks the logic of the situation. Amos created a lovely example. He asked people, which is more likely to happen in the next year, that 1,000 Americans will die in a flood, or that an earthquake in California will trigger a massive flood that will drown 1,000 Americans? People went with the earthquake. The force that led human judgment astray in this case was what Danny and Amos had called representativeness, or the similarity between whatever people were judging and some model they had in their mind of that thing. The minds of the students in the first Linda experiment, latching on to the description of Linda and matching its details to their mental model of feminist, judged the special case to be more likely than the general one. Amos wasn't satisfied with stopping there. He wanted to hand the entire list of Lindas to groups of people and have them rank the odds of each line item. He wanted to see if a person who decided that Linda is a bank teller activist in the feminist movement also thought it was more probable than Linda is a bank teller. He wanted to show people making that glaring mistake. Amos really loved to do that, said Danny. To win the argument, you want people to actually make mistakes. Danny was of two minds about this new project, and about Amos. From the moment they had left Israel, they'd been like a pair of swimmers caught in different currents, losing the energy to swim against them. Amos felt the pull of logic, Danny the tug of psychology. Danny wasn't nearly as interested as Amos in demonstrations of human irrationality. His interest in decision theory ended with the psychological insight he brought to it. There is an underlying debate, said Danny later. Are we doing psychology or decision theory? Danny wanted to return to psychology. Plus, Danny didn't believe that people would actually make this particular mistake. Seeing the descriptions side by side, they'd realize that it was illogical to say that anyone was more likely to be a bank teller active in the feminist movement than simply a bank teller. With something of a heavy heart, Danny put what would come to be known as the Linda problem to a class of a dozen students at the University of British Columbia. 12 out of 12 fell for it, he said. I remember I gasped. Then I called Amos from my secretary's phone. They ran many further experiments with different vignettes on hundreds of subjects. We just wanted to look at the boundaries of the phenomenon, said Danny. To explore those boundaries, they finally shoved their subjects' noses right up against logic. They gave subjects the same description of Linda and asked simply, which of the two alternatives is more probable? Linda is a bank teller. Linda is a bank teller and is active in the feminist movement. 85% still insisted that Linda was more likely to be a bank teller in the feminist movement than she was to be a bank teller. The Linda problem resembled a Venn diagram of two circles, but with one of the circles wholly contained by the other. But people didn't see the circles. Danny was actually stunned. At every step, we thought, now that's not going to work, he said, and whatever was going on inside people's minds was terrifyingly stubborn. Danny gathered an auditorium full of UBC students and explained their mistake to them. Do you realize you have violated a fundamental rule of logic? He asked. So what? A young woman shouted from the back of the room. You just asked for my opinion. They put the Linda problem in different ways to make sure that the students who served as their lab rats weren't misreading its first line as saying, Linda is a bank teller, not active in the feminist movement. They put it to graduate students with training in logic and statistics. They put it to doctors in a complicated medical story in which lay embedded the opportunity to make a fatal error of logic. In overwhelming numbers, doctors made the same mistake as undergraduates. Most participants appeared surprised and dismayed to have made an elementary error of reasoning, wrote Amos and Danny. Because the conjunction fallacy is easy to expose, people who committed it are left with the feeling that they should have known better. The paper Amos and Annie set out to write about what they were now calling the conjunction fallacy must have felt to Amos like an argument ender. That is, if the argument was about whether the human mind reasoned probabilistically, instead of the ways that Danny and Amos had suggested. They walked the reader through how and why people violated perhaps the simplest and the most basic qualitative law of probability. They explained that people chose the more detailed description, even though it was less probable, because it was more representative. They pointed out some places in the real world where this kink in the mind might have serious consequences. Any prediction, for instance, could be made to seem more believable, even as it became less likely, if it was filled with internally consistent details, and any lawyer could at once make a case seem more persuasive, even as he made the truth of it less likely, by adding representative details to his description of people and events. And they showed all over again the power of the mental rules of thumb, these curious forces that they had curiously named heuristics. To the Linda problem, Danny and Amos added another, from work they had done in the early 1970s in Jerusalem. In 4 pages of a novel, about 2,000 words, how many words would you expect to find that have the form blank, 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 ing, 7-letter words that end with ing? Indicate your best estimate by circling one of the values below, 0, 1 to 2, 3 to 4, 5 to 7, 8 to 10, 11 to 15, or 16 plus. Then they put to those same people a second question. How many 7-letter words appeared in that same text of the form blank, 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 n, blank? Of course, there had to be at least as many 7-letter words with n in the sixth position as there were 7-letter words ending in ing, as the latter was just one example of the former. People didn't realize that, however. They guessed, on average, that the 2,000-word text contained 13.4 words ending in ing and only 4.7 words with n in the sixth position. And they did this, Amos and Danny argued, because it was easier to think of words ending in ing. Those words were more available. People's misjudgment of the problem was simply the availability heuristic in action. The paper was another hit. The Linda problem and the conjunction fallacy entered the language. Danny had misgivings, however. The new work was jointly written, but it was, he said, joint and painful. He no longer had the feeling that he and Amos were sharing a mind. Amos had written 2 entire pages of it by himself, in which he sought to define, with greater precision, representativeness. Danny had wanted to keep the definition vague. Danny was uneasy with the feeling that the paper was less an exploration of a new phenomenon than the forging of a new weapon to be used by Amos in battle. "It's very Amos," he said. "It's a combative paper. We'll provoke you with this, and we'll show you that you can't win this argument." By then, their interactions had become fraught. It had taken Danny the longest time to understand his own value. Now he could see that the work Amos had done alone was not as good as the work they had done together. The joint work always attracted more interest and higher praise than anything Amos had done alone. It had apparently attracted this genius award, and yet the public perception of their relationship was now a Venn diagram, 2 circles, with Danny wholly contained by Amos. The rapid expansion of Amos's circle pushed his borders further and further away from Danny's. Danny felt himself sliding slowly but surely from the small group Amos loved to the large group whose ideas Amos viewed with contempt. "Amos changed," said Danny. "When I gave him an idea, he would look for what was good in it, for what was right with it. That, for me, was the happiness in the collaboration. He understood me better than I understood myself. He stopped doing that." To those close to Amos who glimpsed his interaction with Danny, the wonder wasn't that he and Danny were falling out, but that they had ever fallen in. "Danny isn't so easy to access," said Percy Diaconis. "Amos was all out there. The chemistry was so deep, I don't know if it's describable in a mechanistic way. Each of them was brilliant, and that they did interact and that they could interact was a miracle. The miracle did not look as if it was going to survive its removal from the Holy Land." In 1986, Danny moved with Anne to the University of California at Berkeley. the same university that had told Danny 8 years earlier that he was too old for a job. I really hope the move to Berkeley will open a new era with Danny, with more everyday interaction and less tension, Amos wrote in a letter to a friend. I am optimistic. When Danny had put himself back on the job market the year before, he discovered that his stock had risen dramatically. He received 19 offers, including one from Harvard. Anyone who wanted to believe that what ailed Danny was simply an absence of status outside of Israel would have some difficulty explaining what happened next. He went into a depression. He said he wasn't going to work again, recalled Maya Bar Hillel, who bumped into Danny soon after he'd moved to Berkeley. He had had no more ideas. Everything was getting worse. Danny's premonition of the ending of a relationship that he had once been unable to imagine ending had a lot to do with the state of his mind. This is a marriage, a big thing, Danny had said to Miles Shore in the summer of 1983. We have been working for 15 years. It would be a disaster to stop. It's like asking people why do they stay married. We would need a strong reason not to stay married. But in 3 short years, he'd gone from trying to stay in the marriage to trying to get out. His move to Berkeley had the opposite of the intended effect. Seeing Amos more often only caused him more pain. We have got to the point that the very thought of telling you of any idea that I like, mine or someone else's, makes me anxious, Danny wrote to Amos in March 1987, after one meeting. An episode such as the one we had yesterday wrecks my life for several days, including anticipation as well as recovery, and I just don't want those anymore. I'm not suggesting we stop talking, merely that we show some good sense in adapting to the changes in our relationship. Amos replied to that letter from Danny with a long letter of his own. I realize my response style leaves a lot to be desired, but you have also become much less interested in objections or criticism, mine or others, he wrote. You have become very protective of some ideas and develop an attitude of love them or leave them, rather than trying to get it right. One of the things I admired you for most in our joint work was your relentlessness as a critic. You discarded a very attractive treatment of regret, developed mostly by you, because of a single counterexample that hardly anyone, except me, could really appreciate the force of. You prevented us from writing up our work on anchoring because it lacked something, etc. I do not see any of this in your attitude to many of your ideas recently. When he'd finished that letter, Amos wrote another to the mathematician Varda Lieberman, his friend in Israel. There is no overlap between the way I see my relationship with Danny and the way he perceives me, he wrote. What seems to me openness between friends he takes as an insult, and what seems like correct behavior to him is, to me, unfriendly. It is difficult for him to accept we are different in the eyes of other people. Danny needed something from Amos. He needed him to correct the perception that they were not equal partners, and he needed it because he suspected Amos shared that perception. He was too willing to accept a situation that put me in his shadow, said Danny. Amos may have been privately furious that the MacArthur Foundation recognized him and not Danny, but when Danny had called to congratulate him, he had only said offhandedly, "If I hadn't gotten it for this, I'd have gotten it for something else." Amos might have written endless recommendations for Danny and told people privately that he was the greatest living psychologist in the world, but after Danny told Amos that Harvard had asked him to join its faculty, Amos said, "It's me they want." He just blurted that out and then probably regretted saying it, even if he wasn't wrong to think it. Amos couldn't help himself from wounding Danny, and Danny couldn't help himself from feeling wounded. Barbara Tversky occupied the office beside Amos at Stanford. "I would hear their phone calls," she said. "It was worse than a divorce." The wonder was that Danny didn't simply break off the relationship. By the late 1980s, he was behaving like a man caught in some mysterious invisible trap. Once you had shared a mind with Amos Tversky, it was hard to get Amos Tversky out of your mind. What he did, instead, was get Amos out of his sight by leaving Berkeley for Princeton in 1992. "Amos cast a shadow on my life," he said. "I needed to get away. He possessed my mind." Amos couldn't understand this need of Danny's to put 3,000 miles between them. He found Danny's behavior mystifying. "Just to give you a small example," Amos wrote to Varda Lieberman in early 1994, "there's a book on judgment that came out, and in the introduction there's a passage that says Danny and I are inseparable. This is, of course, an exaggeration. But Danny wrote to the author to tell him that it's an exaggeration, and added that we haven't had anything to do with each other for a decade. In the last 10 years, we published 5 papers together and worked on several other projects we never finished, mainly because of me. It's a trivial example, but gives you an idea of his state of mind. For the longest time, even as they went back and forth, the collaboration was over in Danny's mind, and for the longest time in Amos's mind, it wasn't. "You seem determined to make me an offer that I cannot accept," Danny wrote to Amos in early 1993, after one of Amos's proposals. They remained friends. They found excuses to get together and work through their issues. They kept their troubles so private that most people assumed they were still working together. But Amos liked that fiction better than Danny. He had hopes to write the book that they had agreed to write 15 years earlier. Danny found ways to let Amos know that wasn't going to happen. "Danny has a new idea how to get the book done," Amos wrote to Lieberman in early 1994. "We'll stick together a few papers published recently by each of us with no connection or structure. This strikes me as so grotesque. It'll look like a collection of work by 2 people who once worked together and now cannot even coordinate chapters. With the situation as it is, I can't find enough positive energy even to start thinking, let alone to write." If Amos couldn't give Danny what he needed, it was perhaps because he couldn't imagine having the need. The need was subtle. In Israel, they'd each had a cucumber. Now Amos had a banana. But the banana wasn't what was provoking Danny to hurl the cucumber in his experimenter's face. Danny didn't need job offers from Harvard or genius awards from the MacArthur Foundation. Those might have helped, but only if they altered Amos's view of him. What Danny needed was for Amos to continue to see him and his ideas uncritically, as he had when they were alone together in a room. If that involved some misperception on Amos's part, some exaggeration of the earthly status of Danny's ideas, well, then Amos should continue to misperceive. After all, what is a marriage if not an agreement to distort one's perception of another in relation to everyone else? "I wanted something from him, not from the world," said Danny. In October 1993, Danny and Amos found themselves together at the same conference in Turin, Italy. One evening, they went for a walk, and Amos made a request. There was a new critic of their work, a German psychologist named Gerd Gigerenzer, and he was getting a new kind of attention. From the start, those most upset by Danny and Amos's work argued that by focusing only on the mind's errors, they were exaggerating its fallibility. In their talks and writings, Danny and Amos had explained repeatedly that the rules of thumb that the mind used to cope with uncertainty often worked well. But sometimes they didn't, and these specific failures were both interesting in and of themselves and revealing about the mind's inner workings. Why not study them? After all, no one complained when you used optical illusions to understand the inner workings of the eye. Gigerenzer had taken the same angle of attack as most of their other critics. But in Danny and Amos's view, he'd ignored the usual rules of intellectual warfare, distorting their work to make them sound even more fatalistic about their fellow man than they were. He also downplayed or ignored most of their evidence and all of their strongest evidence. He did what critics sometimes do. He described the object of his scorn as he wished it to be rather than as it was. Then he debunked his description. In Europe, Amos told Danny on their walk, Gigerenzer was being praised for standing up to the Americans, which was odd, as the Americans in this case were Israelis. "Amos says we absolutely must do something about Gigerenzer," recalled Danny. "And I say, I don't want to. We'll put in a lot of time. I'll be very angry, and I hate being angry, and it'll be a draw." And Amos said, "I've never asked you for anything as a friend. I'm asking you this as a friend." And Danny thought, "He's never done that before. I can't really say no." It wasn't long before he wished that he had. Amos didn't merely want to counter Gigerenzer. He wanted to destroy him. Amos couldn't mention Gigerenzer's name without using the word sleazeball, said UCLA professor Craig Fox, Amos's former student. Danny, being Danny, looked for the good in Gigerenzer's writings. He found this harder than usual to do. He'd avoided even visiting Germany until the 1970s. When he finally visited, he traveled the streets entertaining a strange and vivid fantasy that the houses were all empty. But Danny didn't like being angry at people, and he contrived not to feel anger toward their new German critic. He even found himself in some slight sympathy with Gigerenzer on one point, the Linda problem. Gigerenzer had shown that by changing the simplest version of the problem, he could lead people to the correct answer. Instead of asking people to rank the likelihood of the two descriptions of Linda, he asked, to how many of 100 people who are like Linda do the following statements apply? When you gave people that hint, they realized that Linda was more likely to be a bank teller than a bank teller active in the feminist movement. But then Danny and Amos already knew that. They'd written as much, with less emphasis, in their original paper. At any rate, they'd always thought that the most outrageous version of the Linda problem was superfluous to the point they were making, that people judge by representativeness. The very first experiment, like their earlier work on human judgment, showed that plainly enough, and yet Gigerenzer didn't mention it. He had found their weakest evidence and attacked it, as if it were the only evidence they had. Combining his peculiar handling of the evidence with what struck Danny and Amos as a willful misreading of their words, Gigerenzer gave talks and wrote articles with provocative titles like How to Make Cognitive Illusions Disappear. Making cognitive illusions disappear was really making us disappear, said Danny. He was obsessed. I've never seen anything like it. Gigerenzer came to be identified with a strain of thought known as evolutionary psychology, which had in it the notion that the human mind, having adapted to its environment, must be very well suited to it. It certainly wouldn't be susceptible to systematic biases. Amos found that notion absurd. The mind was more like a coping mechanism than it was a perfectly designed tool. The brain appears to be programmed, loosely speaking, to provide as much certainty as it can, he once said in a talk to a group of Wall Street executives. It is apparently designed to make the best possible case for a given interpretation rather than to represent all the uncertainty about a given situation. The mind, when it dealt with uncertain situations, was like a Swiss Army knife. It was a good enough tool for most jobs required of it, but not exactly suited to anything, and certainly not fully evolved. Listen to evolutionary psychologists long enough, Amos said, and you'll stop believing in evolution. Danny wanted to understand Gigerenzer better, perhaps even reach out to him. I was always more sympathetic than Amos to the critics, said Danny. I tend to almost automatically take the other side. He wrote to Amos to say that he thought the man might be in the grip of some mind-warping emotion. Perhaps they should sit down together and see if they might lead him to reason. Even if it were true, you should not say it, Amos shot back, and I doubt that it is true. An alternative hypothesis to which I lean is that he is much less emotional than you think, and that he is acting like a lawyer trying to score points to impress the uninformed jury, with little concern for the truth. This does not make me like him more, but it makes his behavior easier to understand. Danny agreed to help Amos as a friend, but it wasn't long before Amos once again was making him miserable. They wrote and rewrote drafts of a response to Gigerenzer, but at the same time wrote and rewrote the dispute between each other. Danny's language was always too soft for Amos, and Amos's language too harsh for Danny. Danny was always the appeaser. Amos the bully. They could agree on seemingly nothing. I am so desperately unhappy at the idea of revisiting the GG postscript that I am almost ready to have a chance device, or a set of three judges, decide between our two versions, Danny wrote to Amos. I don't feel like arguing about it, and what you write feels alien to me. 4 days later, after Amos had pressed on, Danny added, On a day in which they announced the discovery of 40 billion new galaxies, we argue about 6 words in a postscript. It is remarkable how ineffective the number of galaxies is as an argument for giving up in the debate between repeat and reiterate. And then, email is the medium of choice at this stage. Every conversation leaves me upset for a long time, which I cannot afford. To which Amos replied, I do not get your sensitivity metric. In general, you are the most open-minded and least defensive person I know. At the same time, you can get really upset because I rewrote a paragraph you like, or because you chose to interpret a totally harmless comment in an unintended negative way? One night in New York, while staying in an apartment with Amos, Danny had a dream. And in this dream, the doctor tells me I have 6 months to live, he recalled. And I said, this is wonderful because no one would expect me to spend the last 6 months of my life working on this garbage. The next morning I told Amos. Amos looked at Danny and said, Other people might be impressed, but I am not. Even if you had only 6 months to live, I'd expect you to finish this with me. Not long after that exchange, Danny read a list of the new members of the National Academy of Sciences, to which Amos had belonged for nearly a decade. Once again, Danny's name wasn't on the list. Once again, the differences between them were there for all to see. "I asked him, 'Why haven't you put me forward?' said Danny. But I knew why." Had their situations been reversed, Amos would never have wanted to be given anything on the strength of his friendship with Danny. At bottom, Amos saw Danny's need as weakness. "I said, 'That's not how friends behave,' said Danny." And with that, Danny left, walked out. Never mind Gerd Gigerenzer or the collaboration. He told Amos that they were no longer even friends. "I sort of divorced him," said Danny. 3 days later, Amos called Danny. He'd just received some news. A growth that doctors had discovered in his eye had just been diagnosed as malignant melanoma. The doctors had scanned his body and found it riddled with cancer. They were now giving him at best 6 months to live. Danny was the second person he'd called with the news. Hearing that, something inside Danny gave. He was saying, "We're friends, whatever you think we are." Coda, Bora Bora. Consider the following scenario. Jason K. is a 14-year-old homeless boy who lives in a large American city. He is shy and withdrawn, but extremely resourceful. His father was murdered when he was young. His mother is an addict. Jason takes care of himself, sleeping sometimes on the sofas at friends' apartments, but mostly on the streets. He manages to stay in school until the 9th grade. He often goes hungry. One day in 2010, he accepts an offer from a local gang to sell drugs and drops out of school. A few weeks later, the night before his 15th birthday, he is shot and killed. He was unarmed when he died. We are seeking ways to undo Jason K.'s death. Rank the following in order of their likelihood. 1. Jason's father was not murdered. 2. Jason carried a gun and was able to protect himself. 3. The U.S. federal government made it easier for homeless kids to obtain the free breakfast and lunch to which they are entitled. Jason never went hungry and remained in school. 4. A lawyer steeped in the writings of Amos Tversky and Daniel Kahneman took a federal government job in 2009. Drawing upon Kahneman and Tversky's work, he pushed for changes in the rules so that homeless kids no longer needed to enroll in the school meal program. Instead, they automatically received free breakfast and lunch. Jason never went hungry and remained in school. If you found number 4 more probable than number 3, you violated perhaps the simplest and most fundamental law of probability, but you're also onto something. The lawyer's name is Cass Sunstein. Among its other consequences, the work that Amos and Danny did together awakened economists and policymakers to the importance of psychology. "I became a believer," said Nobel Prize-winning economist Peter Diamond, of Danny and Amos's work. "It's all true. This stuff is not just lab stuff. It's capturing reality, and it's important to economists. And I spent years thinking of how to use it, and failing." By the early 1990s, a lot of people thought it was a good idea to bring together psychologists and economists to allow them to get to know each other better. But as it turned out, they didn't particularly want to know each other better. Economists were brash and self-assured. Psychologists were nuanced and doubtful. "Psychologists, as a rule, will only interrupt a presentation for clarification," says psychologist Dan Gilbert. "Economists will interrupt to show how smart they are. In economics, it is completely normal to be rude," says economist George Lowenstein. "We tried to create a psychology and economics seminar at Yale. We had our first meeting. The psychologist came out completely bruised. We never had a second meeting." In the early 1990s, Amos's former student, Stephen Sloman, invited an equal number of economists and psychologists to a conference in France. "And I swear to God, I spent 3/4 of my time telling the economists to shut up," said Sloman. "The problem," says Harvard social psychologist Amy Cuddy, "is that psychologists think economists are immoral, and economists think psychologists are stupid." In the academic culture war triggered by Danny and Amos's work, Amos served as a strategic advisor. At least some of his sympathies were with the economists. Amos's mind had always clashed with most of psychology. He didn't like emotion as a subject. His interest in the unconscious mind was limited to a desire to prove it didn't exist. He was like a man in stripes wandering a land settled by people dressed in plaids and polka dots. Like the economist, he preferred neat formal models to mixed chocolate boxes of psychological phenomena. Like them, he found it completely normal to be rude, and like them, he had worldly ambitions for his ideas. Economists sought influence in the arenas of finance and business and public policy. Psychologists hardly ever entered those arenas. That was about to change. Danny and Amos both saw that there was no point trying to infiltrate economics from psychology. The economists would just ignore intruders. What were needed were young economists with an interest in psychology. Almost magically, after Amos and Danny arrived in North America, they began to appear. George Loewenstein was a good example. A trained economist disillusioned by the psychological sterility of economic models, Loewenstein read Amos and Danny's work and thought, wait, maybe I want to be a psychologist. As he happened to be Sigmund Freud's great-grandson, this was an even more complicated than usual thought. I had tried to escape the family's past, said Loewenstein. I realized I had never taken a single class in what really interested me. He approached Amos and asked him for advice. Should he move from economics to psychology? Amos said, you should stay in economics. We need you there. He already knew in 1982 that he was starting a movement, and he needed people inside economics. The argument that Danny and Amos started would spill over into law and public policy. Psychology would use economics to enter these places and others. Richard Thaler, the first frustrated economist to stumble onto Danny and Amos's work and pursue its consequences for economics single-mindedly, would help to create a new field and give it the name behavioral economics. Prospect theory, scarcely cited in the first decade after its publication, would become, by 2010, the second most cited paper in all of economics. People tried to ignore it, said Thaler. Old economists never changed their minds. By 2016, every 10th paper published in economics would have a behavioral angle to it, which is to say, it had at least a whisper of the work of Danny and Amos. And Richard Thaler would have just stepped down from his tenure as president of the American Economic Association. Cass Sunstein had been a young law professor at the University of Chicago when he came upon Thaler's first war cry on psychology's behalf. A paper Thaler had titled in his mind, Stupid Shit That People Do, he finally published as Toward a Positive Theory of Consumer Choice. Thaler's bibliography led Sunstein directly to the article written by Danny and Amos in Science about judgment and to prospect theory. For a lawyer, both of these were difficult, said Sunstein. I had to read them more than once, but I remember the feeling. It was an explosion of light bulbs. You have thoughts in your mind, and you read something that immediately puts them in order, and it's electrifying. In 2009, at the invitation of President Obama, Sunstein went to work at the White House. There he oversaw the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs and made scores of small changes that had big effects on the daily lives of all Americans. The changes Sunstein made had a unifying theme. They sprang directly or indirectly from the work of Danny and Amos. You couldn't say that Danny and Amos's work led President Obama to ban federal employees from texting while driving. But it wasn't hard to draw a line from their work to that act. The federal government now became sensitive to both loss aversion and framing effects. People didn't choose between things, they chose between descriptions of things. The fuel labels on new automobiles went from listing only miles per gallon to including the number of gallons a car consumed every 100 miles. What used to be called the food pyramid became My Plate, a graphic of a dinner plate with divisions for each of the 5 food groups, and it was suddenly easier for Americans to see what made for a healthy diet, and so on. Sunstein argued that the government needed, alongside its Council of Economic Advisers, a Council of Psychological Advisers. He wasn't alone. By the time Sunstein left the White House in 2015, calls for a greater role for psychologists, or at any rate for psychological insight, were coming from inside governments across the world. Sunstein was particularly interested in what was now being called choice architecture. The decisions people made were driven by the way they were presented. People didn't simply know what they wanted. They took cues from their environment. They constructed their preferences, and they followed paths of least resistance, even when they paid a heavy price for it. Millions of U.S. corporate and government employees had woken up one day during the 2000s and found they no longer needed to enroll themselves in retirement plans, but instead were automatically enrolled. They probably never noticed the change, but that alone caused the participants